Welcome to episode 25 of Island CT Podcast,
a podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick. And together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
So we have really, well, I have not.
Administrative stuff, as usual.
Yeah, I know I was starting there. Patrick has done a lot of updates to our website.
Altered your file? It's huge!
It's huge!
It's the biggest update ever.
Yes, exactly. So we have a lot of new stuff up there.
Should I just read just a little bit off of this? Oh, let me see. Where did our website go? There it is. Let me see. Let me just read from the changelog. Latest update, 2015, December 13th. Added placeholders for all older blog and full blog lists. Added directories for every missing blog entry and filled it with all I had transferred from the old server. Made notes about what it missing in the blog list. Added podcasts 13, 14, 15, and 17 without notes. Tried to get podcast 16 processed, but something happened, blah, 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 blah. Went to Island CT website builder version 0.1.2. Major change in format of podcast. I'm only on line 5.
Of
how
10.
Many lines are there? Was this more? They're like 25 lines here.
Yes, it's a huge amount of changes.
I really worked to get this up and running.
Which is wonderful. So Patrick's been striving to get all of our blogs up to date.
Yep.
And podcasts.
And we're pretty close.
Yeah.
We're almost done.
Basically. It's actually, I'm the one.
Well, I have two also.
Do you?
I don't have as many as you. You have like four.
I have a few more. Two. And I will be finding the...
And all our podcasts are up.
Yeah.
Including the one from Bear Island, which is going to be so tough.
So what's exciting about it is that we are kind of amazed with what we're able to put together this year. And it's been...
Really cool.
Really exciting for us to see how much
we covered. We should talk about all of this type of stuff in the next one, because that'll be the last one of the year.
Yeah, we will.
So let's move on.
Okay, we'll move on.
Couple things more about the administrative stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't say it's a podcast about stuff and education and anything else.
Mm-hmm.
We're taking that out.
We are.
Because we think we're going to talk about... Well, first of all, we always forgot, but... I think we had a good idea pretty much every time about what we thought we were going to think about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we thought about a few seconds and it's like, oh, it's about this, it's about that. But sometimes we ended up talking way more about something else.
Right. And we would get bits and pieces of news on science or wherever we happened to be reading and our conversations in the car on the way to work. And it would totally transform what we were thinking was just a little topic. We're like, oh, I guess we've covered that a little bit more than we had expected.
And that happened almost every time with something or other or a couple things.
Which was a lot of fun, but it was just unanticipated.
Yeah. So the new plan is we're going to decide on a one or two word title for each podcast after we're done.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll put that up with the podcast name. Let me see. There was one other thing. Oh, yeah. We apologize for Kelly's audio.
Yes.
So I tried to fix it, and we only realized this was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh.
Now it's really low. And
Wait, did you listen to yourself?
I did.
Okay.
And now it's going louder again. It's...
No, do you know what's... The low, that's me, unfortunately.
Oh.
That's going to be really tough on me. That's okay.
Okay.
But you listened to yourself while recording and it didn't sound like an ogre,
mm-hmm.
right?
No, it did not.
Because that destroyed one of our podcasts.
It did not.
So.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to work on it and hopefully we'll have it fixed by the next one, because it should be just a setting somewhere.
Right.
It sounds, because you're getting heavily clipped.
Mm-hmm.
And when we try to adjust the recording level in Audacity, it still clips it, but it just gives you a lower recording volume.
Basically, so, I think Windows is taking it over in part of their speech-to-text modification for some kind of app.
We don't seem to have control over the recording volume being sent to Audacity.
No. And so, I'm not sure what is in play there, but yeah, we'll find it.
Anyway.
Okay.
All done for administration.
Yep.
I think, unless you have something.
Nope.
Blog entries?
Yeah. So my blog entry was writing grants with students. So right now Donors Choose is having a special offer where they're trying to, or they will help fund a student grant, a student-initiated grant. Half of the funding will be provided through a funder that Donors Choose has.
Oh, I didn't realize Donors Choose came up with the idea to have the kids do part of the writing of the grant.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. So that was part of the initiative, is to get the students to have more student-driven grants, which is exciting. And so now the Makerspace, when I told them that like 3 weeks ago, they were all excited. And there's two groups that got very excited about two ideas that they wanted to do. And now I have two partially done grants, but the students are putting so much work and thought into the development of them that I've just decided to go at their pace and not to force it through. And it's been interesting, because it's neat how the kids are like, oh yeah, we have to work on our budget today. So, Mrs. Sears, we're going to work on the budget today.
Cool.
And they're going to see, you know, the media specialist who knows the company that he orders the plastic filament from for the, you know, the MakerBot that they want to use to do the 3D printing so they can get the cartridges, the right cartridge for it. And so it's all good stuff. It just takes a little more time.
So there's two separate projects, am I right?
Yeah, it's two separate projects. One student in particular is really excited about using Spheros to teach out physics. And he thinks that by using the Spheros, he'll be able to combine a neat introduction to simple machines and introductory to blocky code programming that might entice a few students to get more involved in both programming and science.
So is this kid like leading a group, or is he writing the grant?
He's writing it by himself. We're writing, you know, as we write together, I put down students because I'm waiting for someone to jump on.
To jump on, yeah.
And
sure.
I don't want to limit it to just this is
of course,
his yeah. grant. He's like really serious about it. He sits with me at lunch when I have lunch duty, and I have my computer up, and we write a few more lines. We think about what we're going through, and it's really interesting because he's doing it because he's excited about what that grant will do.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And he has a vision for it. And so it's a slow process because I don't want to steamroll, oh, you mean da-da-da-da. And so I have to wait for him to give me the details so that I can help support.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it is neat.
What's the other project?
One project is they want to build a drone. And they want to build it to run on a Raspberry Pi. At first, they were going to buy a drone.
And they want this to be a flying one.
Yeah, they want it to be
a flying drone
that's run by a Raspberry Pi. And they have been looking through different projects online. Mm-hmm. And they have chosen one that they think that they will be able to do with the equipment that we have. And they're going through, and they're doing, you know, they're being very thoughtful. Yeah. They were asking me, so do you have any hexes?
Hexes.
You know, hex screwdrivers.
Oh, yeah.
And things like that. I'm like, oh, yeah, we have those. And you wouldn't happen to have a soldering iron. So they're really trying to think of all the tools. Yeah. And they've been asking me about each tool, and then they check it off their list. Okay, she has that. She has access to this. And the ones I don't, they'll like go home and check to see, yeah, my dad says we have this. He's willing to give us this to use.
Is there a deadline for when these have to be
See,
used?
I think that we may get kicked off over the holidays,
right.
You know, for what we have. However, I'm just like, whatever, we'll just put it up after the holidays.
Uh-huh.
And they'll have that information up there.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Moving on to mine?
Yeah.
Okay. So, a little bit of history here. So, I wrote blog entry 49.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when we finally got our transmitter to put out the power. And so that was all good. There's still a little bit of a worry, because the whole idea behind making this transmitter was to use the SI-5351, which we've talked about a fair bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the largest package in which we can get this piece is an MSOP 10, which has tiny, tiny little feet.
Right.
And it's by far the smallest thing we've ever had to solder.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went ahead and made the Oshpark board, but it was like, you know, if we can't do this, this is going to be a problem. Anyway.
Right.
So we were finally able, well, I was finally able to put it together and test it, and it worked. And so that's what I wrote about.
Very exciting.
And, I'm not going to go into what I wrote in detail, but I just covered kind of our history, the different stages we went through,
mm-hmm.
starting with just converting DIPs, dual inline packages, to surface mount just by bending pins and stuff, going to smaller and smaller,
mm-hmm.
until finally our big stumbling block was the TQFP for the 18 mega.
Mm-hmm.
That I was burning those up, and finally got this one. And then there's a little added thing, part of it, where the crystal that came looked slightly different than it did in the data sheet. The crystal that acts as the timer, the base timer for the SI-5351. And the first one didn't work, and I took the crystal off. So I wrote up exactly what the problem was and how to, this thing that you got to watch out for. There's this little note in the data sheet,
mm-hmm.
about not all the crystals being the same and pins being marked differently. And, but that's the very last step now, that for things we weren't sure were going to work for our transmitter.
Right.
Although I was always, like, well, if it doesn't work, we'll just use the Adafruit board or something. It would have,
mm-hmm.
been a bummer.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot
definitely.
More work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is going to be all integrated into the board.
Nice. Nice.
So that was my blog entry, number 51, about the mm-hmm. SI-5351 MSOP 10.
So the reason Pat has his blog entry already done.
By the way, I just have to mention the MSOP 10. The pitch on those, I wrote it down. It is 500 microns. That's half a millimeter between the center,
wow.
of one pin and the center of the next pin, which means that each pin has to be less than half a millimeter in
right.
size, or it would take up the whole space.
Right.
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 And I really didn't go in the blog, I didn't talk about how I did it. There's lots of tutorials out there about,
mm-hmm.
and some of them have contradictory things they say about
yeah.
the best way to do it. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, everybody has to find their way.
Right.
I think the bigger point is I have a bit of shaky hands, and I was really not confident, but slowly over time was able to do it. So, I mean, I think everybody should be able to do this.
Neat.
Just takes practice, patience.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so
nice.
That's it for the blog entries.
Mm-hmm. So what I was saying before is the reason Patrick is done with his blog entry before the Sunday due date right now is because he's on vacation.
No, that's not it.
No? Oh, I assumed it
was. I was at Falls Lake the entire, or a large part of the day before. I just did the, so the interesting thing is when we work at the Art of Type stuff in the building, I tend to write good notes. Mm-hmm. About what I'm doing to keep track.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just talking about our blog entries. It's nice that you have broader ones and mine are narrow and are going to be for another few months,
mm-hmm.
as I have to stay focused on getting these things built.
Right.
Built. But it also makes that a lot of the blog entries write themselves,
mm-hmm.
because I look at my notes. It's not written perfectly for a blog entry, but it's just changing things around that I'd written for myself.
Mm-hmm.
The pictures are already there, and probably you can notice that in the doc in the pictures that I putting up on the blog. They don't always match the blog exactly in what they're explaining,
right?
Because the pictures are there to document what happened or mm-hmm. something I found, and then I just grab them and put them on the blog,
right?
So so you know, it makes it easy for me to write the blogs.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I am on vacation and doing work on Falls Lake mapping.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we'll talk about that later. You know, that's a huge part of what we're doing. Because that'll be part of future plans. We don't have anything to show for it yet.
Right.
So
I have a few very short articles that I came across in Science just today, and it's from the December 18th issue.
I don't recognize that one.
And I just wanted to mention both of them because one was talking about
the
Syrian refugees struggling with TB. And so they have 2 million refugees who have fled from Syria. And it's like the challenge is with these refugees being a mobile population is to, you know, monitor TB and to keep track of it. And they were like, you know, 20% of those diagnosed with TB are lost in follow-up cases and don't complete 6 month regimen of, you know, any kind of
is
medication.
Is that because they're still mobile populations?
Yeah. And you know, here you have a population that is at risk for sickness in general because of poor nutrition and fatigue and, you know, limited housing.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, you know, if I was thinking more deeply about it, I'd be like, that would be an issue. But I just, it didn't really kind of register until I read that little blurb.
So how long is the treatment?
What's that?
Did you say 6 months?
So, no. They said less than 6 months. So the treatment isn't 6 months. No. It's just this particular, they don't complete a 6 month treatment for a cure of TB. Okay.
But you're supposed to.
Yes, you are.
Well, I mean, that's not incredibly surprising for something like TB, right? Because it walls itself off. But it's like, you know.
And you think of the cost and trying to, you know, get the drugs to the people who need it. It's just very challenging with a mobile population that doesn't have a residence.
So, and the 6 months is probably like you get treated for a while and then they really don't know whether it's gone yet, maybe. So then you have to come back and get checked.
And
if it's come back, and only if you've been without it for a long time do they say, okay, you're clear.
And then, you know, you start to think, wow, how will this impact antibiotic resistance?
Oh, yeah.
You know, in a population that's mobile and not being tracked.
Right, because that's the nightmare scenario is you get people partial treatments so that the bacterium gets exposed, but then makes it through.
Right.
And then the next generation.
Right. Or,
can
yeah.
deal with.
Yeah. You know, you're on it for 4 months, the patient's feeling good, yeah. and is moved to another location. Why bother with medication? I'm good.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
kind of deal. So, anyway, I just thought that it was worth bringing up tonight. Also, I love the new GM chicken eggs. And so they have these new eggs that have just been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, in the last week, and is to treat lysosomal acid lipase and LAL deficiencies. And it's a rare genetic disorder that prevents the body from breaking down fats. And it's something that they will be able to get from the egg white and then administer through intravenous. And I just think it's just a really cool thing to be able to have a chicken make the drugs for you.
Sure, sure.
Anyway, it's one of those like, wow, look at that. So neat. And
you know what egg white is?
What?
It's mucus.
I know.
Gotta love it.
You gotta love the mucus.
I love the mucus.
So that's the two little articles that I thought were pretty cool, and just a quick little mention. So what do you have?
Well, I think I want to start, so we'll stick with biology for a bit.
Okay.
Maybe the big one.
Okay. The big one.
It's two articles, three kind of, depending on how you look at it. It's two research articles and a perspective or a background.
Okay.
And it's all about mitochondria. Oh, it's from Science. Oops. Let me see. I should have the
4th of December, 2015.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Volume 350, issue 6265.
Okay. Anyway, so I guess mitochondria, you know, they split and then they fuse again and they split and they fuse. And that's, I guess, all regulated.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found is that the function of the mitochondria is tied to its morphology. Now, this is something I don't think we understand even a small fraction of the interaction here and what's required. But one thing that I remember studying metabolism is you have metabolic pathways that are associated with the mitochondrion.
Mm-hmm.
And you figure, well, a mitochondrion is a mitochondrion and all this stuff can happen in there. Before an animal is born, the heart, it doesn't have a heavy load.
Right.
Right? It's in the womb.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have a lot of availability of oxygen.
Right.
Because all the oxygen has to go through the mother's lungs.
Right.
And then to it through the, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's got a lower availability of oxygen.
Right.
But it doesn't have a huge load. Well, that's glycolysis. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the mitochondria are good at processing glucose.
Mm-hmm.
In adults, well, way before adults, as soon as the animal's born, suddenly, there's plenty of oxygen around.
Right.
But the load on the heart, it's in a gravitational environment where it's got to support itself and everything. The load on the heart goes through the roof.
Right.
And there's a shift in the metabolism carried out by the mitochondria. They're going for this from this glucose utilization to more free fatty acids coming in from the blood and being oxidized. Well, they took the mice and they made mutants where it stopped in the heart the conversion of mitochondria from one form to another. And basically, it stopped the mitochondria from being moved into this special lysosome, I guess, which I don't know if it totally I don't think it totally destroys them, but it destroys a lot of the mitochondrion.
Right.
And then it gets regenerated into new mitochondria. And if you stop that from happening, when the mice are born, the mitochondria don't shift to fatty acid oxidation. They stay glucose utilization. And the heart, and that's not enough for the heart in this new situation. And the mice all die of heart failure.
Wow.
And if you look at, let me bring up the original article. We won't have a picture of this. Let's see. So I'm showing Kelly. It's not of, so Kelly will have to say that, yes, this is true, what Patrick is saying. So they show micrographs of the hearts at 1 day's old. And you see these mitochondria, and I circled some in yellow. This is
right.
I did it with Xernal. And they're kind of like small or elongated and curvy. And it's the same in the wild-type mouse and the one that had this protein called parkin disrupted. And parkin is required for moving the mitochondria into this, what they call an autophagosome.
Mm-hmm.
That destroys or partially destroys the mitochondria, but at least allows them to change, right? Now, in the wild type, 5 weeks after they're born, you can see these, all the mitochondria are nicely aligned and they're big and fat.
Mm-hmm.
And in the one, in the mice that had the parkin disrupted, basically they look the same as they did before. They're elongated and stretchy and stuff, so it's like the shape of it is somehow tied to its ability to change its function. And they also show sections through the heart, and before they're born, or at 1 day old actually, you have these little heart and big muscle tissue and all looks nice, and then 5 weeks old, the wild type has this huge ventricle. And then this, on the left side, you know, thick wall. And then a thin wall for the right side where it has to go through the lungs, push the blood through the lungs. So there's not as much force it has to generate. So the the thickness of the wall is not too big. And then you look at the ones, the hearts of the mutant mice. And their heart is hugely engorged and the right ventricle is larger also, and it just looks all stretched down, and it just doesn't look good. And these are really cool pictures.
Mm-hmm.
It's in, those pictures are on page 1220 of Science, and they're in the original research article. So that was kind of neat. And the other article, that's also original research, sounded even more interesting, and I didn't get to read practically any of it. But there they also disrupted the ability of mitochondria to fuse and then come apart. And it seems like the control of fusion and fission, I guess, you know, the splitting apart, is controlled by one molecule in a long form and a short form. I can't remember which one does which. And normally there's a balance. It goes back and forth. But when they stop this from happening and they cause stress, then the mitochondria tend to split, which is normal for stress, right? And they go into this glycolysis mode, which is what we saw with the fetuses, right?
Right.
And it's also something you see with people that have heart failure, right? And they also tend to have smaller mitochondria. Well, in these mice, they get heart failure. But what's really crazy is if you put these mice on a huge, very high fat diet, it's like you force the mitochondria to get back into this oxidative metabolism thing.
How weird.
And the mice that have this mutation that was introduced are rescued.
How bizarre.
Yeah. So, but there I'm really kind of talking about what I know nothing about, mm-hmm. because I read just the beginning of this and it was just fascinating. And, anyway, I'm going to call it here because I just want to keep talking about this. Mm-hmm. And this is really all I know about this.
That is very strange.
Yeah, three really cool articles.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to close them up and we can move on.
That is really cool.
Do you have something or do I have something next?
I have kind of a fluffy one.
Okay. Are we moving away from biology?
No, this is another biology one. So this is fish. And it's a news article that was just put out December 10th. Mm-hmm. And in 2015.
I didn't see it, but I saw your write-up on it.
Yeah. And so it talks about, like, you know, if fish are not killed quickly, mm-hmm. and they just are left to kind of drown for a while before they're processed, that they actually release chemicals that cause our food to taste less good, and they also don't not less good doesn't taste as good, and the shelf life of those particular fish are not as long as ones that were harvested quickly.
So they mention
ketones and
hydrogen peroxide.
Hydroperoxide breakdown.
Yeah.
And so...
Well, you figure if you have hydroperoxides, anytime you have peroxides, you've got two oxygen molecules bound to each other, and they're going to come apart, and then you're going to have two free radicals, and it's going to take apart anything it touches.
Right.
So you're going to have to make a mess if you're making lots of peroxides.
Right. So... It's interesting.
But they seem to specifically say aldehydes and ketones here for some reason.
Right. And so it gives it that more unsavory meat and a foul smell. So I just thought it was interesting. And because it was printed in the news portion of Science, I think there'll be an article out soon to give us some more information about it. So just a quick interest article.
Okay.
Okay, how about you?
Staying with biology for a bit?
Mm-hmm.
The aurochs.
Yes, I didn't get to read it,
this is great.
But I've heard about them a bit because I read about them a year ago.
So this is something that's been in the news before. Mm-hmm. So the aurochs is the extinct ancestor to modern cattle.
Mm-hmm.
And... they had, I don't see exactly where, but I think it's like in the 1600s.
Yeah.
The last of them died in Poland somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surprising how long people have been trying to bring it back. I think it started in the early 1900s, late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
One big experiment was... by two brothers called the Heck brothers, and so now there's Heck cattle.
Heck cattle. Yeah. I just love the Heck brothers.
And that's from, I think the latest experiments for those went on until the 1930s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of those cattle, this was in Germany maybe, or Poland, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them survived World War II, so there's Heck cattle today.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, so I guess basically the idea is that even though the aurochs is gone,
right,
modern beef cattle
mm-hmm.
came from the aurochs, or at least a lot of them did.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that, or I don't know if it turns out it's really true, but we think that the genome of the aurochs is still around you know, isn't as much as it can, as at least one copy mm-hmm. possibly could be, in parts in different cattle breeds.
Right.
Especially, there's this thing I hadn't heard about before. They call them heritage breeds. I guess they're ones that have been not bred in with more modern breeds or with mm-hmm. each other through the ages, but have been kept separate. So they tend to stay more to one genetic line that's therefore more ancient. So mm-hmm. people are using all different methods to try to get as close to the Urochs as possible mm-hmm. by interbreeding these heritage lines and then seeing what comes out and trying to pick ones that they, that look like the Urochs should look. And that was a big animal. Mm-hmm. I think, I don't know, I saw somewhere over here, it was like up to a big one was up to 100 and up to a 1.8 meters at the shoulder.
Wow.
Like,
yeah.
That's as tall as me.
Yeah.
At the shoulder.
Yeah, I was about to say they look kind of like they're taller, like a yeah. moose.
And I'm not a short guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love the way they talk about rewilding Europe.
Well, that was, so actually that's the most like, significant part
isn't that
in a
strange?
Way. I mean, it's, there's two issues there. There's mm-hmm. bringing back the Urochs and it looks like they're not really going full steam into the genetic manipulation yet. They're just doing mostly breeding.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, I think they have the Urochs genome from available to them if they wanted to totally.
They've been working on it for a while. It's part of a de-extinction project in Europe.
Well, but the point is they have the sample, right? They have a real they have real Urochs tissue
mm-hmm.
With plenty of DNA in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the other issue is what you said. It's the rewilding of Europe. I mean, it's not just the Urochs, but there's all these different places where they're trying to bring back animals, always only herbivores, that were there in the wild situation.
Mm-hmm.
And not just to make the area so that it has wild animals, but to control the plant life. So part of the idea behind the Urochs is to have them graze and tromp down on the new trees and keep areas more grass-like.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they have these places set up as reserves and stuff, I guess wolves and bears a lot of times just show up from the wild. And
mm-hmm.
So you, and lynx.
Right.
I don't know. On page 1147, there's a map that shows right. all the places in Europe where they've tried to set up these places that are more wild. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
horses. Anyway, I read the whole thing, but that was like early last week. Haven't looked at it since then.
It would just be such a huge animal to come up to.
Yeah.
You know, walking in the mountains.
Yeah. No kidding.
So, very interesting, though. And it, you know, it's just, I had heard about the project before, and it's...
Well, here it is. The last known survivor died in a game reserve in 1627. In what is now Poland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, and nuclear genome of a 6,750-year-old fossilized Urochs from the United Kingdom published in October.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the genome.
Yep.
Of one. You know, it's funny to say, okay, it's still present in animals today, right? But a population of animals can't live without diversity, right? The founder effect
right.
is a problem. So just because a single genome exists does not mean you can have a viable population, number
right.
one. Number two, what does it mean, right? Because this genome is not necessarily going to be from one individual.
Right.
Will it put together parts that are incompatible
mm-hmm.
that would cause disease in it, right?
Right.
Anyway. So, moving on?
Yep.
More biology? You have... Can we get through this without mentioning the C word?
Well, okay. So it just says...
No, we can't.
It's an editorial in Science about CRISPR. And it's just, it talks about, you know, just...
Was it in the very last Science?
Yeah, it was just in December 18th issue.
Yeah, I think that's the last one.
Yeah. And it just talks about how CRISPR is really poised to change the way, a lot of science.
Oh, no. The last one I have is December 11th.
I know, I cheated. I looked up.
Oh, there's a new one?
Yeah, there's a new one just published. So there is a little editorial about CRISPR and just the advances and how... It will.
So what's the big thing they're mentioning as the worry?
It's just a transformation and how it's going to change a lot of sciences.
Yeah.
And also, it's starting to be used in the human genome, and. You know, used for engineering and producing opiates and things like that. So it's really, it's a lot of power.
The human
and
connection is
connection
is and with the human genome
and it's not really
fiddling around with it.
Is yeah, but thing. It's not really saying, "Oh my goodness!" It's just like, "Wow." Who knows? You know, yeah. It wasn't meant as, you know, yeah. Oh my goodness. I saw it as who knows what's to come on the horizons with this.
Yeah.
And how will it impact just science itself and the branches that it will create.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting how, I mean,
it was a very light article, by the way.
I'm looking at your computer and I just noticed Talons. Being mentioned mm-hmm. somewhere on the last column and stuff. It's really, CRISPR is just not new at all. Mm-hmm. It's just easier than it's ever been.
Right.
And now everybody gets a chance to fiddle around with genomic mm-hmm. procedures that before it took an experienced lab to be successful. And now you can just try it, seems like. And, well, it's not so difficult that... You've wasted a year without getting a paper published, you know. It's mm-hmm. like, hey, well, okay.
Right. So it's more of just the, you know.
Just the speed.
Speed
and cost being reduced for doing experiments.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So, anyway, just something to mention. So.
I think that's all our biology.
And, yep. And I like what I just saw, the CubeSat. I wanted to hear about those. I didn't get a chance to read up on CubeSats.
Do you want that now?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So we talked about CubeSats in the past, mostly about this one company.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember. They wanted to continuously take pictures of the Earth.
Right.
And be able to cover the entire Earth every 24 hours.
And they were going to make their data public.
Yeah.
Wasn't it a public data project?
It was partial.
Okay.
The idea was you make the raw data public, I think, but then if you want certain types of analyses or whatever, then you have to pay for that. I mean, it seemed at the time like a good business model. I don't, they actually don't, I don't know if I talk about it in this article. This article, by the way, is on page 1302.
Mm-hmm.
And... It's marked News in Depth, so I guess it's a news article. It was mostly restricted to the fact that a lot of people are now interested in using CubeSats for weather reporting. Mm-hmm. And the big deal is that before now, there are two main sources of data to feed into your weather models, which have now been... become really successful at determining, mm-hmm. at forecasting the weather, at least in the short term. And one are weather balloons.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they're always going up all over the place continuously. And as the weather boom goes up, it mm-hmm. records data as all different right. levels there. But we don't get weather balloons over the ocean. We right. just don't. And the other way to get data is these like billion-dollar, huge, like a bus, satellites up high, taking all these different pictures mm-hmm. of the Earth. And when you need to put a new one up, it's just an unbelievable investment. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are getting old and stuff. CubeSats, instead of doing all these measurements, what they do is, or the way they're being used now, is, and they have a name for it. I can't find it. Okay, I'm not going to look for it. But there's a special name for this technique. There's GPS satellites all over, mm-hmm. right? There's our GPS satellites, which we just call GPS. There's the European ones called Galileo, mm-hmm. which are coming online. I think there's quite a
right.
few. There's GLONASS, the Russian system. Mm-hmm.
There's the Japanese.
I don't think the Japanese have one.
No, I thought they did. Because it's part of their system for atmospheric monitoring.
GPS?
Oh, sorry. These
are GPS yeah, type satellites.
Yeah.
For
sorry,
positioning.
My mistake.
And then the future looks bright mm-hmm. because both India and China want to develop their own systems.
Oh, wow.
So these satellites, in order to be able to pinpoint where you are or where some receiver is, mm-hmm. have to have very precise timing.
Mm-hmm.
But if the signal from the satellite arrives at your CubeSat and it's grazing over the atmosphere,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be diffracted or refracted. I'll have to
right.
look up exactly the difference there. But and so the timing is not going to be the same as if it had gone through empty space.
Right.
And since your satellite and your CubeSat and the GPS are both moving, every few seconds you get a different path through the atmosphere. As they get closer, it gets higher.
Right.
As they get, you know, if they're going further, you get have to go through more of the atmosphere. So just like with a weather balloon, you're getting this profile of the entire atmosphere.
Right.
And you can get all sorts of estimates of temperature, water content, and stuff by how much you get of this diffraction. Not only that, but you're getting at each CubeSat a signal from a whole bunch of GPS satellites. Because up high, you can see a hell of a lot more of them
mm-hmm.
than you can down on Earth. I guess that's important. I just made that up. That's possibly important. I actually don't know. But it seems like that, you know, that
right.
may be important. On top of that, unlike the giant bus-sized satellites, you've got many, many satellites,
right.
CubeSats potentially up there,
right?
Constantly making these measurements. So the cost of doing this is potentially a hell of a lot cheaper. We'll cover over the oceans with no difference than over land, and is possibly going to be really good for weather monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
A bit of a worry that the U.S. Agencies involved in weather forecasting have, and possibly, I don't know, other countries also, is that right now, these are government agencies.
Oh, got
it. So they share data like, you know, that's
mm-hmm.
part of their job.
Right.
They're like, well, what if we start depending on these companies and they make us pay and then they have these restrictions? Well, we don't mind paying because we don't pay for their huge satellites, but then we don't have the capability. And then they say, well, we're not sharing data with anybody else. That's a problem.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Very
cool
and
stuff.
One thing that was really fascinating is that the CubeSats, that one... Planet Labs, that was the company.
Mm-hmm. You're right,
California.
It was Planet Labs.
The number of satellite companies planning or already having CubeSats up there for the weather monitoring part is just, they list like 3 or 4 of them.
Wow.
Planet EQ, out of Colorado, and Spire out of San Francisco, and I think they mentioned at least another couple. Maybe not. I don't know. Anyway, so there's definitely a whole bunch of them out there.
Neat.
Compared to what they call the big government systems.
Mm-hmm.
The Joint Polar Satellite System, JPSS.
Mm-hmm.
At NOAA, that project, they're planning a launch for 2017 of JPSS-1. The project is $11.3 billion.
Wow.
Anyway, so...
It reminds me a bit about that one researcher we read about. And he is monitoring the ocean, but instead of using larger devices, he's using really small devices that are more free-floating mm-hmm. on the ocean, so they don't have to have propellants and things like that.
Right.
But they're just kind of going along with the current and monitoring atmosphere, water temperature, you know, salinity, all of these things.
And because they're cheap, he just releases a ton of them.
Right.
Oops.
And then he can monitor them for, like, months at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, it just is, it's a kind of a similar idea. Nice. Good stuff. So, what else do you have for us, Pat?
I have two. I have the Greenland one.
Oh, I did want to hear about that. I did
you
not.
You have the MOOC?
I do have the MOOC.
Greenland goes along with the satellites in a way.
Okay, how about we do the Greenland first?
Okay.
Because I was really interested.
You just closed the phage therapy. Are we skipping that one?
I thought we were.
That's okay.
Okay.
That's okay. So, it'll come back.
Mm-hmm. I guarantee. That's what I'm thinking.
Or maybe it won't. Then it'll be, maybe it'll be a big flop and we can talk about that. Anyway, was it last podcast or the one before we talked about, I think it was the last
one. It was the last one.
Yeah.
Where
there was a review or a news article.
Right.
And they really didn't give lots of information about the significance of, or we didn't think there was a lot.
I was disappointed that I didn't have some kind of data.
Yeah.
And it was missing from the review. And it was a very short one-page review.
Yeah. The one piece of information I got out of it was that there's glaciers on the east and the west, and the ones on the west were really speeding up,
mm-hmm.
but not much had been seen on the ones on the east, but then suddenly this one on the east started to speed up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, so this one talks about two glaciers. It's an original research article. I don't think there is any news or perspective for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's on page 1357. And, okay, I'm going to say the names. They talk about two glaciers, and it sounds like they're talking about exactly what the news article talked about.
Right.
It's two glaciers on the east side.
Mm-hmm.
One is the Zachariae Istrum.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to call it ZI.
Okay.
Which is what they call it that's how they label it in the article. And the other one is the Njörgalsjörn glacier.
Okay.
That's the best I can do. Although I did practice a whole week.
Trying to.
No, not this, but see, I don't know. I don't have a clue because I'm just guessing, right? But when the volcano in Iceland went off.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Yafitjökull. See, I got that. They have all of these Icelandic people on YouTube. You can hear them say, Yafitjökull. Anyway, doesn't sound anything like that when you read it looking at the letters. But
yeah.
Anyway, so the second glacier we'll call NG, the Njálsfjörðurinn Glacier, NG. I'm going to go right to the picture. I didn't read the whole article because it's original research and it's not really my field.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, it drains the northeastern... It drains out of Iceland
mm-hmm.
towards the northeast and hits the ocean and the northeast side of Iceland. And I guess it drains more than anything else on Iceland. And I told you, I think the amount of ice on Iceland that it drains, for one of the glaciers, it's equivalent to a half meter rise of ocean levels over the entire Earth.
Yeah.
That is an amazing amount of ice. How is that even possible from an island? Because we all see Iceland as huge on maps because of the projections, but you look on a globe, it's not that... I mean, it's big, you know, mm-hmm. but that's amazing. But that's just one of the glaciers.
And that covers a great deal of land in.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, half a meter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because you have these gigantic floodplains
right.
in coastal areas, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's just one of the two glaciers. The two glaciers drain the same general area, the inland, and it kind of splits as it comes towards the ocean. And together, they have an equivalent amount of ice of 1.2 meters
wow.
of ocean level. So that's what you were saying last mm-hmm. time. What does it mean?
Yeah, that's that what was missing.
Lot,
yeah.
Right? Anyway, the NG Glacier is the more northern one, and it's sped up, but it's not incredibly dramatic. It's sped up. But the Zi Glacier, which is the more southern of the two, it had, let me see if I can find the dates here. It was relatively steady for a while, and it was retreating slowly, and then in 2012, it just went into overdrive.
Mm-hmm.
And what they think happened is that there was seafloor that they couldn't see before, and mm-hmm. it looks like it went off over... So it leaves land and starts to go over water, and it goes over water for a while, and you've got this huge mass, and then it reached this ridge, and then for a short while, then it's got to bump over this little
right,
ridge.
Right, so it's kind of like a stop.
It's an underwater
it's
ridge,
stopping
but it's,
it.
And it's not so much it's stopping, it's like scraping on it,
okay.
and then it's calving on the other side of that.
Got it.
And with the warming temperatures, the warm water was eating away underneath it, and it got thin, and suddenly the warm water had access to that inner pool of water on the inside of the ridge.
Oh, so it's speeding up the process.
And that suddenly, when it got in
oh,
there, they
got
thought
it.
It just suddenly started to take it apart. And then when it suddenly sped up, I don't know how much of that had an effect, you know, upstream, like up the ice stream,
mm-hmm.
as to whether that was caused that to speed up. So, and they don't see anywhere that that's going to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now that it's going. So basically they're saying this is going to dump this fresh water into the ocean for now possibly decades, and it's going
wow.
to go really fast.
Wow.
So
my response when you said 1 meter was to go over to the NC
Department
of Transportation,
yeah.
Where they replace the bridge on Highway 12 almost every, 5 to 10 years,
yeah.
depending on the hurricane that wiped it out, because it's constantly being, you know, broken away because of flooding and
where
that.
Is this?
Oh, it's on the coast. And
is
what
it
does.
On the Outer Banks?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it goes to this very wealthy area where people have these huge houses that are built too close to the water.
Right.
And And I'm like, yeah, there we go, Highway 12 again, and I won't get some funding for my classroom. I'm teasing. But it did make me think about Highway 12. Another thing, I looked up something about Greenland, because you said you were going to do something on Greenland. And I just saw this other news article, and basically looking at Greenland and geologic time scale, and they have recently found that 1.25 million years ago that Greenland was almost free of ice. So
1.2 million years ago.
Yeah.
So that's a long time
ago. It is. It's a long time ago. But anyway,
is that before the ice ages started to come back and forth?
Oh, you're going to push any kind of knowledge that I might have about that. I am not sure.
Because I think ice ages are kind of on a, I don't know, I'm guessing like 20,000 year cycle or so. So that's a lot. That's like 10,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Plus 250,000 years. That's, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you think in the time of the dinosaurs, well, that's way before that, 65 millions. So there was no ice ages going back and forth with warmer period, you know, interglacial periods then. I don't know. Time of Lucy? That's...
Yeah.
That's definitely a lot younger than Lucy. I mean, Lucy's got, 7 million years ago? 5 million? I don't know.
I'm not sure.
Anyway,
I just thought
totally ice-free.
Yeah. I just thought it was kind of a neat little interest article to go along with it.
And the connection with the Greenland research and the satellite stuff, I mean, it's not connected to CubeSats at all, but a lot of their measurements have to do with surface measurements of ice and all that type of stuff you get from satellites.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is that it for glaciers?
That is it for glaciers. And that
we're moving through a lot better.
And let's see.
Are you doing
MOOCs? And one last article about MOOCs. And it's this article called Democratizing Education, Examining Access and Usage Patterns in Massive Open Online Courses. And apparently they offer these online courses as a new way to bridge the gap and to really provide education to all. But
this is like a critique of that theory.
Yeah, right. It's a critique of that theory. And what they found is people that have access, they are going on and using those things, but there are also people that come from higher education background, more affluent background.
Yeah. I mean, it's the typical problem that you have you would like something to be good for lower income and less educated people to help them, bring them to the same level as others. And suddenly this great thing is actually more beneficial to people that have more funds and already more education because they have the time to devote to this type
also,
of stuff.
Also, they have
and
connections.
The knowledge that it even exists.
Yeah, they have Wi-Fi at home that works, you know.
Yeah, right,
and,
exactly.
And what I find is for many of my students, their Wi-Fi, either they don't have it at home or it's just not at a level that they can use.
So how do you feel about the possibility of, you know, some places the government is supplying Wi-Fi to places?
They're doing it in Chapel Hill, too.
This they, is the local government?
Yep, yeah. Local government is providing it. The Chapel Hill web, you know, or online Wi-Fi, it's not as strong for the kids to actually do a, like, they couldn't do a module on it. It may get them to a web page to read about, but it won't run a lot of simulations and models without kind of breaking down in between.
So it can't stream video?
No, because, and so I've used it around town where Kara and I have tried to access it at coffee shops doing planning together, and it's a much weaker platform. And you know, it might be just the amount of people using it that it just gets overwhelmed at certain times.
If you can't stream video, then you're not going to be able to do anything, because some people will try to stream video no matter what.
Right.
And then that's going to, and you can't figure out who those people are. I mean, or you can't, you don't know what people are going to use their Wi-Fi for. You can't just.
No. And we were just trying to use like a Google document that we had as shared, and we were being booted out of our Google documents so that I would have access and then she would have access to it. And so we, you know, so it was like, okay,
to use Git.
Can that. Yeah, that's right. That's what we should be using. So,
well, that'd be a different experience actually. You know, there's this thing, OwnCloud. So maybe for another day.
Yeah. So anyway, it was just interesting. And then the other point that the article brought up is the computers are used with students of lower income for drill and practice. And some of the...
Right, how they use it was different. I remember that.
I thought that was very interesting, because I remember visiting a school that in North Carolina, but it was in a smaller rural community. It was a Title I school. And I was like, wow, oh, do you have, you know, you have computer, because they had this computer room that you could take your class to. And I'm like, wow, you have a computer room, like you go, everything's set up, you're ready to go. And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty impressive. And they're like, yeah, but that's really the testing room. So that's where they go to do their, you know, their monitoring of how the students are doing, which the kids go in and take a standardized test like once a quarter.
Horrible.
And so I was like, oh, that's so sad that's the main use of computers is to assess where the students are at, but the students don't have as much time to actually do the simulations and things like that with it. Yeah. Now, this was a few years ago, but I was surprised. And, you know, it's just unfortunate.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't teach kids to explore and investigate using some really cool tools like Zooniverse or things like that the
cool.
kids could really get into. I've started to use it this year. The kids have really been amazed by it.
No, Kelly, you wrote a blog entry about it.
No. I started using it with my new students in eighth grade earlier, because last year they liked it.
I just went through all of our blogs and had to transfer them over from the old server.
No, my current students, I meant. Yeah. So.
By the way, can I read this quote?
Mm-hmm.
It is just great from the MOOC article. With radio, the unprivileged school becomes the privileged, was the promise of the 1930s. In the 1960s, boosters declared that television would, in quotes, make available to these young people instruction of a higher order than they might otherwise receive. In the first years of the 2010s, technologists have heralded the possibility that massive open online courses, MOOCs, can democratize education. And it's like, oh man, do people never learn?
Yeah.
So, well, the other way to look at it is, let's not never stop trying.
Right, exactly. So, who knows what will.
But there's a lot of hype.
Yeah.
No question about it. I'll tell you one thing that's... The internet has made one thing possible that I don't know if people saw, or maybe some people saw coming, but it's this situation where you have people commenting on things and writing up explanations for things that you can just search and see mm-hmm. many different people's explanations. And you know, and on some sites they're ranked, right? And you can, I just never post on forums, never have. I've always found it already. There's nothing I've come up. Well, that's not true. I've searched for stuff and not found it. But almost everything I've looked for, I found people already have gone past what I've been able to do, or the software technology isn't there yet. It's
right.
not ready, right? And just the ability to find out all this stuff from groups that have decided to take on certain topics or certain interests because there's that many people in the world that can connect to each other and they become a community and they feed on each other in terms of their knowledge and then they get raised to a higher level while before everybody would be working on their own, you know? Anyway, that's really cool. I mean, I think that's the type of thing that's made it that we can use the SI-5351 with the AT Mega and me seeing why that would be so useful.
Right.
Because I keep coming across amateur radio people having used it, even though that's not where I'm going with it. I'm going with the sports aspect. It's just, oh, right. You know, for Art of, we don't need to tune, so maybe it's simple enough that I can do it. There's all these explanations out there. Okay, I'll use that chip. And it's crystal controlled, even though it's,
right.
it's, you know, not directly run from the crystal. And also, it should be really stable. And that's what I need if I'm going to set it out in the wild out there, exposed to the elements. And so, and that would have never happened if there wasn't all these communities that had decided, you know, oh, let's investigate this way of doing it.
Right. You know? Right. Exactly.
And then kids, and then I'll build these things, and then kids will go out in the woods like they did already when we were up.
Oh, exactly.
Befuddling around with technology and stuff. It's all awesome.
It is.
Okay. Close the MOOCs.
Yep.
In terms of articles, I don't have real articles anymore.
I don't either.
News type stuff and stuff we were doing.
I think
I have one news one.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
The Akatsuki spacecraft, you remember a few days ago? Was in the news that it finally got into orbit around Venus.
Neat.
And it's going to study its atmosphere and possibly see if there's volcanoes on Venus. So,
very nice.
Oh, wait a second. No. That's... So it just got into orbit after failing like a year ago, I think it was. Or maybe longer. Just got into orbit. But because it's going to have to do all these adjustments, we're not going to get actually any data collected until next year, I don't think.
Right.
But I don't know. It's kind of cool.
That is.
Venus is a pretty crazy place with, it's, I remember reading the Wikipedia on it, and it mentioned one of the things I found wild is that it's one of the only planets, or maybe the only one, where the winds are going around faster than the planet body underneath. Well,
wow.
Everywhere else in the solar system, the planet body underneath goes around at a speed, and the winds go around, but
right.
not as fast.
That is cool.
Anyway, I thought it was a fun news item.
That is.
And then NASA just got huge funding.
Oh, yes. We heard that from
Isaac.
Yeah.
That was cool.
That was neat. It's nice to hear that he's still very excited about keeping up with their funding.
Okay. I have... Let me see. I've got lots of work that we did next. I don't really have any more articles.
Yeah, I think we should move to that.
Okay. So, that's kind of like future plans. Well, stuff we did first.
Mm-hmm.
We went to look for the Geminids.
Yes.
Was that on, that was last Sunday morning, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Or Friday, or Monday morning? I can't remember. But it was cloudy.
Right.
And then it had opened up by the time we got in the car to go to work. We're going to work. And we noticed the clouds had gone, but it was right. already getting light.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have been Monday morning.
Yeah. So,
but we didn't get to see anything.
No. My friend did.
At school. Really?
Yeah. So she had to go pick up her daughter at the airport very late.
Yeah.
She goes, we're driving home. It was the strangest thing. Did you know? And I'm like, oh, you got to see them. That's so awesome. She goes, it was for that few hours that it was really clear. She goes, we got to see them on our way home.
Cool.
So I was happy for
it. I reading up about them, it was neat. So they're slow moving.
Yep. Right? And she said you could see them move. It looked like they moved further along the sky.
Yeah. Because your eye gets to see them faster, right?
Yeah. And she said, and you could track them much easier.
That's neat.
Yeah. So
how would you get slower moving? You'd almost think it's like wherever they are. It's like they're going in the same direction the Earth is or something for them to go slow. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't
or
know
just
how
not,
it works.
Anyway.
But, yeah.
But it's one of only two comets. It's one of only two major meteor showers of the year, like famous ones, that actually doesn't come from comet. It comes from an asteroid. I think.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think so.
Oh, interesting.
You want me to bring up the Wikipedia?
Yeah, sure.
Geminids. Meteor shower caused by the object 3200 Phaethon. 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 Which is thought to be a Palladian asteroid.
Wow.
With a rock comet, in quotes, orbit. Huh.
That is really cool.
Slow moving. December. Anyway. So, that was kind of cool.
Nice.
I mean, it was kind of cool to go out looking for them.
Yeah.
It was a bummer we didn't get to see anything.
It was. But it was, the weather was out of our control.
Okay. Activities?
Yep.
And future plans kind of together.
Okay, yeah. So we were out to Falls Lake over the weekend.
Yep.
And we went out both Saturday and Sunday.
Yep.
Saturday, not too much happened, but we got a late start.
Well, we put out a few.
Yeah, we put out three. But Sunday was much better. And it was a matter of, we probably needed Saturday to get back into it, to be honest.
Well.
And to get everything together and to kind of have our system down again.
Yeah, we were a bit later.
We were, but it also I think it was a system thing.
Yeah.
You know, and getting back into it. And we had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It was a very beautiful day.
Although I have to say that Sunday, when we turned back, we probably would have gotten an extra two or three placed if we hadn't hit really bad stuff.
Yeah.
So I just went out yesterday. And it was a nightmare. I went for the
why
section.
Was it a nightmare, Pat? You have
it's
to explain.
Like thorns and brambles, and it was just, it took me half hour to get through just like 200 meters at one point.
We're talking dinosaur thorns that rip your clothes. It's not just like, oh, a little thorn. It's like something that would, like that wants to rip any nylon jacket that you might wear.
I think they're possessed.
As
you walk by and you're past them, they come up out of the ground and grab your back. And it's not just that, but, you know, I was trying to do the mapping. And you go in one direction just desperately trying to find a way through because you know people are going to have to go from one control to the other, and you want to mark dark green for some areas, and then be like, okay, they're going to have to go around this. And I walked for 20 minutes in one direction along this stream, thinking I was going to go around, and I came to this wall of this stuff. There was it was absolutely impassable, and it went as far as I could see to the north and as far as I could see to the south. It was just a wall. And I'm like, well,
Now, we never knew what was, you know, that bushy green area that was marked, and I just decided...
Well, this area was marked white.
Yeah, no, I understood that, but that one part on Sunday that we walked across, and then afterwards, you go, we should have walked through it, because, you know, we should really know if it's passable.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
Which was totally right, but I'm like...
we might have turned around.
I don't know. Yeah.
Just mark it green, and if someone makes it through, then
more power to you. Even when we advertise for the course, we're like, wear old clothes. Make sure.
But that does cause a problem, because we went into this thinking it's not going to be like last year.
Right.
We're going to set it the way we have it planned, and then we're going to go in and map, which we couldn't do last year. We didn't have enough experience or time. And we're going to map, and then they'll be able to see where the dark green is and go around it. And now I'm like, I don't think some of the areas where we place controls according to the map, I don't think it's going to be possible.
Right.
So I'm thinking, okay, let's go out there this weekend and from the last control we do have, try to find a way into the... Because I really want to get to the far reaches. Otherwise, we're not using... Have, you know, people are going to keep doing the same places around this area.
Oh, yeah.
And the far reaches are never used. So I'm like, okay, let's go down there somehow. You know. Anyway, so let's see. Other activities. Is there any more about orienteering?
No, not right now. No. I have to get working on open orienteering.
Mapper. Me too. We want to get the OCAD and see if we can import it, and because then that'll really work with our mapping. So, yeah, that'll be real techie type stuff to do. So, and maybe we'll have a summary when we review what the different greens versus hash green versus different color oranges.
Right.
Or we'll go over that when we do the mapping.
Yeah.
Building stuff. We talked about the SI-5351 being built. So that's really cool. Sent in a bunch of Oshpark boards to be made. Let me see. The voltage regulator, the controller, the RF power chain, which should be here any day now. I still have to do the switches. I think that's all. And then we put together the full board. The power chain is going to the RF power chain is going to show up before Christmas, but everything else isn't going to show up until Christmas, so we'll be gone. Future plans.
Yep. So our podcast next time will be hopefully on the road, but we aren't sure how that's all going to work out.
From Canaan Valley in West Virginia.
So hopefully, we'll be like saying, oh, and we got this awesome snowstorm. It just came out of nowhere. But we will see.
We are going skiing.
Yeah. That's why.
We hope.
Skiing, maybe biking. I'm not sure.
have they had snow at Canaan Valley yet?
They've recorded a half inch.
Half inch.
Yeah.
Not exactly exciting.
I know.
But hopefully.
So.
Let's see, I'm looking at what else we've done. Falls Lake, some more Geminids. Some website stuff. Oh, this is really huge. I enabled SSH. I don't know if it was automatically enabled or what for the Island CT website.
Oh, yeah.
And I got into it with SSH, and I could look around and stuff, so that was fine. So then I logged out, and then later, I use rsync to back up the home computers. I like to pull always because mentally it's easier, but then I didn't want to have to deal with logging into their computer and from their computer trying to pull from ours. So I was fooling around with how to push just on a local network, and I got that figured out. And then I set up these fake, they're not fake directories, they're just directories with made up stuff, complicated stuff inside. And then I did the same thing. Well, then I ran rsync over SSH to our website, and I logged in, and it worked. So I could basically update files on our web hosting service, on their server, from a single command at home.
Yeah, which was neat.
So
that was big.
Oh, we didn't mention the... I just talked about the SI5351 soldering on the MSOP 10 blog entry. So we're doing this podcast, podcast number 25, to be out on December 20th, which will be this Sunday. We're recording it on Thursday.
Right.
Did we mention it? We've totally forgot to mention all that stuff, I think. Anyway, my blog entry is not up yet.
No, it will be up soon.
It'll be up on Sunday. And so I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to take SSH and I'm going to try to update our whole website with just that one command.
Right.
So that should be really...
That's neat.
An interesting stuff if that works, hopefully. But I think it will.
That'll be cool.
You don't know, I checked Bear Island camp availability.
Oh, did you?
Yep.
Nice.
For, let me see, it looks like July 9th through July 17th. Almost all campsites are available for that week that we would want it, except for sites 1 and 2.
Oh, wow.
And that's it.
Yep.
That's all I have.
Okay. Well,
do we have future plans? Or is that it?
I think that's it for tonight.
Okay, great. So, thank you for listening to the Island CD podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.